Hello and welcome to the Monocle Arts Review with me, Tom Edwards. On this week's programme, we're going to the theatre. Critic Matt Wolfe will be guiding us through some of the shows on stage here in London this week. And we'll be talking television too. Arts and entertainment writer for The Telegraph, Alice Vincent, is also in the studio with a couple of Netflix releases. And I'll be chatting to some Monocle staffers to find out what's on the box in their respective home countries at Christmas. Plus, of course, we'll have this week's global countdown. Where will we be heading? Stay tuned to find out. All that ahead on the Monocle Arts Review. Matt and Alice, welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you with us. Let's begin with a trip to the theatre, more specifically to the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse at Shakespeare's Globe, where the musical Romantics Anonymous is currently showing. Matt,
yes.
What's the story here?
Chocolate. A lot of chocolate. You get offered chocolate when you come in. It's set in a chocolate factory. Funnily enough, it's about 5 minutes from a theatre called the Meunier Chocolate Factory, more of which in a minute. And it is probably the ideal seasonal entertainment. It's almost impossible to imagine going to this and not coming out just wreathed in smiles. It's based on a movie from 2011, which I confess I'd never heard of previous to this, called Les Émotifs Anonymes, about two sort of social isolates, one of whom is the proprietor of a chocolate factory and the other of whom is a wizard at making chocolate. And she, the wizard at making chocolate, is a dapan in the kitchen, but not really good at anything else. And so she has to learn to come out of her culinary mode and embrace the world. He has to learn that, you know, people are people, not just sort of objects of confectionery. And it is very, very delicate, enchanting, very Gallic. It's directed, interestingly, by Emma Rice, who has run Shakespeare's Globe for the last couple of years. And she's had an abortive tenure, as people probably know. She was more or less given her walking papers by the board. Mm. And this is her final production there. And the funny thing is, the last couple of productions she's had there have had nothing but raves. So I wonder how she's feeling, having been ousted from a theater to which she is bringing some of the best reviews the theater's had.
Well, more on her in a minute. Alice, would you be tempted by this? A romance of shy chocolatiers. You've seen it.
No, I've not seen it, but I have, on the strength of everyone's like incredible reviews, I am taking my mum and dad
on
our producer's birthday, in fact, the 23rd of December, for a celebratory Christmas activity.
So, Matt, you can, I guess, assure Alice, good choice, right?
I've already checked with Alice that she and her family like chocolate, and I've been assured that they do because they are in for a good time.
Lovely, yeah. Sweet stuff. Just on that point about Emma Rice, it is interesting. I know we probably should talk more about the shows rather than the behind the scenes, as it were, goings on. What will her legacy be then? I mean, is it sort of complicated, that verdict, by the fact that she's had a couple of late successes?
I think actually she is coming out of it brilliantly well. She's got a new alliance, for lack of a better word, with the old Vic. I would imagine there was some sort of deal that was struck because she didn't get to live out her contract at the Globe. As I said, the reviews have been excellent. So she can kind of go, bye-bye, you didn't want me, onto happier, sweeter pastures. So it's kind of, in a funny way, it looked like a kind of premature defeat, but it's turned into a sort of win-win.
So rather than, I was going to make a pun about a bittersweet moment,
yes,
but it's kind of sweet-sweet.
It's sort of sweet-sweet. Yes, the bitterness has been erased.
And am I right in thinking, it's a musical, is this correct?
Yeah.
So,
and it's got a really lovely score by a pair of New York composer-lyricist duo who although I'm from New York, had not come across before, and they are really, really good at a time when we need more people running for the musical.
Well, theater. I was going to say, do they have legs? Because often we see these kind of shows, and if the music hits the spot, it can kind of take on more of a life of its own. So
they do. Their names are Michael Kumin and Christopher Dimond, and they are definitely worth watching and particularly hearing.
Excellent. Well, that's a pretty enthusiastic endorsement, which has already been taken up by one of our own critics, which I rather like. Romantics Anonymous runs until the 6th of January. Let's head, Matt, you whetted our sort of chocolate-themed appetites by mentioning the Meunier Chocolate Factory. Barnum is on show. This play was originally shown in 1980, I think.
Yes.
This iteration stars Marcus Brigstocke as the titular character, the great showman, I guess, of the 19th century. How does Brigstocke do, first of all?
Well, being of a certain age, I actually saw the original production on Broadway in 1980.
That's fine, Matt. That's good background.
Thank you very much, Tom. And the great legendary Jim Dale, who won a Tony Award for his performance, opposite a then-unknown leading lady by the name of Glenn Close. And it was one of those sort of seismic star turns where you just thought, wow, this guy can do it. And around the same time Michael Crawford was playing the part here in the UK in a production I didn't see. The thing about the musical Barnum is it has to meet one singular criterion, which is that the person playing the title role has got to be mega charming and mega physically adroit. Because the first act finale, spoiler ahead, is that he has to walk a tightrope from one side of the stage to the other. And Jim Dale and Michael Crawford apparently went to circus schools to learn how to do it. I don't know what Marcus Brigstocke went to, but it's kind of wince-making because he just can't do it. He's very genial. He has a nice smile, and you kind of will him into delivering, but he can't particularly sing the Cy Coleman score, which is a very good, jaunty, honky-tonk score. It's got some good tunes, and when it gets to the physical business, it just looks like he'd rather be anywhere else. So you sort of wonder how it got that far.
Well, on that point, it's interesting. You reflect on what the director said. He claims he's stuffing the greatest show on earth into the smallest theatre. And people who've been there will know it is compact.
Yeah.
So is that another challenge that it doesn't quite live up to? Or on the settings?
Well, all that does really is make the embarrassment factor a little bit more acute because you're that much more on top of it all. Mm. Actually, if you had a great Barnum, there would probably be no better setting because what they've done is they've sort of stripped out the seating as was. It's entirely in the round. You're kind of encircling the action. It's like being in a big top tent. And this is, of course, P.T. Barnum of Barnum & Bailey Circus renown. And that's great. From the minute you enter the space, you're in an immersive atmosphere. So the pressure is, I suppose, redoubled on the actor playing it. And I just kind of thought, It's bewildering. That's all I can say. It's head-scratching that it got this far.
And as we sometimes talk about actors or actresses who push the envelope, challenge the preconceived, you know, casting rationales and this sort of thing, and I guess it's good in a way that people try and push themselves and maybe there's bold casting decisions made, but people do need to, as it were, Matt, and again, pun alert, yeah, you need to walk that tightrope fairly desperately.
You're firing all cylinders today.
I'm possibly not the best person to ask. And firstly, because before I came into the studio, we had a conversation in the Telegraph Arts desk being like, oh God, he couldn't make the tightrope. You know, this is something that has been already a bit, oh God, no. It's just too awkward for British audiences to deal with. But also, this summer I had to witness Marcus Brigstocke holding a kind of a Prince celebration evening at Latitude Festival.
Oh, wow.
And I'm a big Prince fan, and I thought this was literally the worst thing you could do to honour Prince's memory ever. I think if you want to push the boundaries, there are so many other ways than getting yet another kind of white man into a key role on stage. So I think I'll leave it at that.
That seems like very fair criticism, if you ask me. Mm-hmm. Barnum is on at the Menier Chocolate Factory until the 3rd of March. Let's nip into the restaurant De Chume, shall we, Matt? Perhaps not the usual place for a show, perhaps not what our listeners would have been anticipating, but the very popular Indian restaurant is putting on an immersive theatrical production, and it is called Night at the Bombay Roxy. Did it leave you with indigestion?
Well, it left me loving the dal and the biryani and the matar paneer. The whole thing is kind of a elaborate stunt to peddle the soft launch of this franchise, the De Chume franchise, which is wonderful, wonderful food. Of course, you know, the press are well treated at these events. If I had to spend £72, I'm not sure I would have wanted to bother with the theatrical side of it, which is also immersive, except it doesn't involve Marcus Brigstocke. Maybe Marcus Brigstocke would be happier in the environs of De Chume than as P.T. Barnum, because one of the funny things is that all the wait staff, who are all entirely delightful, at the very end all turn out to be fledgling chorus boys and girls kicking up their heels. But there's a kind of cheesy plot involving criminals and betrayals and double crossing that takes place in between the courses. And you just sort of think, can I be left to have my lovely naan in peace? And why all this distraction? So great, great grub, not quite so sure about the rest of it.
Well, yeah, to sort of misquote, I think it's Mark Twain, a good meal spoiled potentially. As would you approach this with reservations?
It's just a cute, well, reservations is
the key word. I'm telling you, it's even by accident it's happening.
I mean, this is going to sound terribly cosmopolitan, metropolitan, but like, as anyone who lives in London and has frequented a shoom over the last 5 years will know, they don't take reservations.
Yeah.
And if you want to eat that delicious dal, which is the best in London, you have to wait for like 40 minutes. Mm-hmm. So I don't know why they're making it even more popular.
Dare I ask you about the nominal storyline behind the unfolding?
It's all very sort of, well, it's in an Art Deco environment. It's supposed to be this glamorous, jazz-inflected landscape of baddies, and it's so paper thin. One of the things in Barnum that they make a big thing about is how you can hoodwink an audience with anything if you just give them enough of what P.T. Barnum calls humbug. And Night at the Bombay Roxy is entirely a study in humbug with great food.
Okay, so cheesy.
Well-seasoned hump.
Paneer-y, maybe, paneer. I should say. Yeah,
paneer-y. Okay. This is just epic.
You can catch A Night at the Bombay until the 14th of December. Now it's time to turn on the television with Alice Vinson. Or actually today, we're firing up our laptops, maybe, or integrated units, whatever. I don't know how people work. Both choices are Netflix programmes. The first one we're going to discuss is She's Gotta Have It, a remake of the 1986 film by Spike Lee, the same name, of course. He's back on board to direct, as I understand it. I guess remind us helpfully what the film was about, first of all.
The film was about a young black woman who is an artist called Nola Darling. And she, it was a film that was very important from a perspective of female sexuality and black female sexuality, because this woman, Nola, she didn't know what kind of man she wanted to date, so she just dated all three of them simultaneously. And they eventually sort of got together, twigged this out, and things unfolded. She became celibate. There was a rape scene. They were sort of pitted against each other. And she comes to the conclusion in the end that, you know, monogamy is for losers.
And it's interesting, and of course, go back to the mid-80s, you know, pretty groundbreaking in a lot of those depictions and thematically. Is this one of the things where the update has to change her situation much to reflect ever-changing times? Or
how
do they sort of address
thing.
That?
Yeah, so obviously Spike Lee is a director and, in this case of the film, an actor who is firmly rooted in Brooklyn. His Brooklyn roots is what made him very famous. Over the last 30 years, dramatic things have been happening to Brooklyn, namely gentrification. Spike Lee has decided to keep his remake in Fort Greene, which is where the original was. It is a neighbourhood in Brooklyn, predominantly black neighbourhood, which happens to have lots of very nice brownstone houses where rich white people have moved in and changed the neighbourhood. So yes, it is set there, but it's also set in 2016. There's a whole episode dedicated to Trump's election, for instance. And so, you know, gentrification is written into it. Cultural identity, politics are written into it. Feminism is written into it. Thankfully, that very controversial rape scene is not written into it. And if anything, I feel like this whole TV series is somewhat of an atonement on Spike Lee's part for that inclusion in the first place.
That's interesting. And he's always been very playful as a filmmaker in terms of how he's mixed in his different mediums. The role that music's played has always been very profound. And there's some interesting devices, I guess, in this, which we'll ask you about. Let's hear a little bit of a clip, first of all, to set the scene.
As a sex-positive, polyamorous pansexual, monogamy never even seemed like a remote possibility.
Doesn't it get confusing juggling all of them at the same time?
I'm used to knowing what I want in relationships and in my art, but lately I'm just so confused.
So tell me a little bit about the men in your life.
Oh, God.
Mars makes me laugh until my sides hurt.
Yeah?
Greer is spontaneous. Nothing is ever the same with him. Jamie's grown, and he cares about me in a way that no one ever has.
Your name leaves my lips the moment I wake from slumber.
So let me ask you about some of the devices we see. Alice, there's an interesting sort of use of the cover art of the songs that feature. Tell us about how that works.
So what happened, I mean, obviously it's a visual medium. I will do my best to narrate what happens.
I only ask easy questions here.
Well, children, sit down. Essentially, music is incredibly important. So a track will be playing and soundtracking a scene, and then it'll come to a natural close, both the scene and the track together, and you'll see a flash of the record label, old style LP. And it sounds gimmicky, and it is a little gimmicky. I think a lot of Spike Lee's directorial touches are gimmicky, but it works to suddenly build up a kind of a cultural identity, and to a certain extent what times are being sat next to each other. So you've got these very 2017 scenes, but maybe you've got a record from the 70s, and it's a very interesting device.
Matt, quite playful and involving lots of other references to art and music and this kind of thing. Now, as a sort of someone who wears a broad-brimmed cultural hat, does that appeal?
Yeah, I think this sounds great because, for instance, theatrically, we just had a stage version of Network at the National, which is a 1976 movie that in the theatre is set in 1976. And there was such a great missed opportunity to translate that to the world of today. As also Spike Lee has done brilliantly, is not so much revive the material, is revise the material. And that is really smart. I can't wait to see it.
Well, and just on that point, I guess maybe some producers are a bit cautious about not rewriting things because then people will level the charge. Oh, well, come on, why did you bring this up to date? It was written for that time.
Yeah, and then, of course, there's a whole
thing understandable
that the title is actually a misnomer because they're not getting what they expected. But this sort of plays to my accordion theory of art, which is that stuff can be compacted or expanded. And it sounds like, in this case, he's really cleverly expanded it.
Well, She's Gotta Have It, the TV series, and the film are both available to watch on Netflix right now. Elsewhere on the streaming channel, we have something, I think it's safe to say, a little different. Mindhunter. This psychological thriller takes place in the 1970s and follows various FBI agents and a psychologist trying to get into the minds of imprisoned serial killers so they can understand how they think in order to prevent future crimes. Nice premise, isn't
Cheery
it?
Cheery stuff.
Yeah. Is there a bit of playfulness here, or is it pretty grim?
It's really interesting that Matt mentioned Network then, because it's set at exactly the same time. 1977.
Of course, yeah.
Is it easy to watch? Well, it's being called Netflix's most binge-worthy? Bingeable?
Bingeable's good.
Binge-alicious. Most binge-watching show available on Netflix, which is quite an accolade given its remit. I didn't like it, so I struggled to get through much of it. And this is because I found it quite leaden. It was written by Joe Penhall, who Matt will be far more familiar with work with. He's a British playwright who deals a lot with psychological dramas.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you'd think this is a good fit, but I think the characterisation, the conversation, the dialogue is a bit woolly. What is, you know, leading people in is the fact that, as a premise, it's quite cinematic. The characters do the same thing every episode, which is they meet, they interview some criminals, they discuss their findings, they go home to their dinner, on and on and on. Except woven into it is a subtle, clear psychopath who is on the brink of murdering lots of people. And that's what keeps people watching.
Now, it is funny, because you mentioned Joe Pennell there. Big reputation. Well warranted, I think. Yeah. Matt, you'd probably agree.
Yeah, sure.
You've also got fantastic directors. The likes of David Fincher, Asif Kapadia, brilliant documentary filmmaker.
Right.
It's kind of like this had to work, no?
Yes. I mean, I maybe am the exception to the rule. Like, everyone I speak
to
about
this.
That's good. Everyone I speak to about this is like, oh my God, Mindhunter, I watched it in 10 seconds and five eyeballs at once. Like, it is very beautifully shot. You can tell that they've thought about the styling of it. It's got some of those Fincher-esque camera movements. It should work. The other thing to mention is the main character. Matt, you're familiar with his work.
Is this right? Jonathan Groff?
Exactly.
Yeah. He's a Broadway actor who was in Spring Awakening, the musical, yonks ago, and more recently was one of the King Georges in Hamilton. And he's a big, big deal in New York. And it sounds totally, totally out of left field, given the sort of stuff he's done before.
Well, I was going to ask you about that, because I guess we've talked a couple of, you know, you talked going right back to 1980 and you see luminous performances and you're like, wow, this is someone on the brink of stardom.
Yeah.
Stardom maybe, but of a different sort. So you wouldn't necessarily have had him down as the big, serious, dramatic screen type.
Well, no, but I mean, of course, if you follow the theatre, one of the things that's always really intriguing is, do these actors ever find their moment on screen? A lot of them don't. And maybe this is his moment. Would you say it is? I mean, does he carry it?
I'm not convinced by him, but I think he's also overshadowed by a lot of other bigger characters. I mean, he's the kind of your classic brooding detective. Even, I mean, that's what's naff about it, is that all those like tropes that you see in True Detective or any other detective, it's like, oh look, there's no objects in his house because he just has to fill it with newspaper cuttings and thoughts. Like, there's a lot of cliche in there. And I think everyone's more interested in the mustachioed criminal who's clearly going to turn into Dennis Rader, the very famous serial killer, who wasn't caught until 2005, which means that there's potentially a lot of Mindhunter to come.
There you go. So you can see why the producers like it, I guess, right?
Yeah. And the commissioners. Ooh, 3 decades of hunting him down.
That's a lot of hunting.
Yeah. Mindhunter is available to watch on Netflix now. Bingeability TBC. Go and judge for yourselves. Follow Alice's advisory. Alice, thanks for talking TV with us. Now, while we're on that subject, let's look ahead to Christmas. Here in the UK, December's one of the most popular times for families to gather around their TVs and watch numerous Christmas specials, dramas and repeats. But what about elsewhere in the world? In our winter weekly newspaper that's just gone on sale, each week we're looking at what's on the telly around the globe this Christmas. And to discuss their respective countries with me, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Chiara Remella joined me a little earlier. Fernando, Chiara, welcome. Let's talk television. And I guess there's a sort of seasonal quality, but we're also kind of looking ahead at things that are coming up in 2018. And Chiara, a quite, I don't know how to call it, amazing lineup from the motherland.
Would you expect anything less?
No, and I know, now you've actually shown me one or two highlights from the Italian television pantheon. And I must be honest, they're often quite surprising for one reason or another. How do these the things that you've written about in the first edition of the newspaper, the one that's actually out now, how do they fit into that, the family of TV reference points?
We're really running the gamut. But before we dive straight in, I feel like I have to make a premise, which is I think a lot of different countries have a series of personalities that they associate particularly with Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day. They know that they are going to be on telly on that day. And I think the case with Italy is that Christmas is a little bit like Ferragosto in August, which is a true no-work holiday. You don't really see an awful lot of newsrooms kind of operating frantically on the 25th. So the programming on the 25th is usually just back-to-back really old movies, like Eddie Murphy 1990s kind of specials.
That's not that old.
No.
Hold on a minute. Yeah, but I know what you mean. But presumably there's quite a lot of shiny floor, glitzy, glamoury, fun kind of narrative.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, I think let's begin with what for me ushers in the Christmas season, which is Luciano Littizzetto's Letter to Santa. Now, Luciano Littizzetto is the comedian who always does a bit of a sketch at the end of the Sunday night talk show called Che Tempo Che Fa, hosted by Fabio Fazio, who is the journalist doing the interviews on the show. She comes in at the end and always does a bit of a kind of riotous, really, really funny sketch. But on the last episode before the Christmas break, because they're going to break, of course, she does a letter to Santa every year. And naturally, this just goes into all of the embarrassing things that have happened over the past year and just makes really ridiculous requests about getting some people out of where they are, or, you know, just going for it. And she really doesn't hold back. And even though this is pre-Watershed, she's been known to make the odd reference to what children shouldn't be listening to.
Ecco. Come stai?
Bene.
Ciao.
Ciao.
Ciao, Lucianina.
Pensavo di andare direttamente dalla Clerici alla prova del cuoco domani mattina.
Stasera abbiamo fatto un po' tardi. Taran, taran,
taran. So that's Fabio and Luciano. And then I guess, yeah, as we sort of move more into the season, what else? Who else should we look out for or listen out for?
Well, I think it'd be nice to move on to Antonella Crelici, because Luciano Littizzetto actually mentions her in that clip that we've just listened. She says, I might as well be Antonella Clerici at La Prova del Cuoco. Now, who is Antonella Clerici? Well, many people ask me that, actually. She is this this home cook style cooking show presenter who, before becoming a cooking show presenter, had absolutely no experience in being a cook whatsoever. She was a journalist, she was a presenter. She'd done lots of sport presenting, actually. But her hallmark curls, golden curls, which kind of cover half of the surface of her upper body, have just made her into this icon. And she's kind of a bit awkward. She dresses really flashily. But weirdly, all of this has just made her more endearing to the whole country. She has the all-important midday slot. So, you know, this is when your kind of stay-at-home mum will be watching, will be following. And the recipes that she does are just so unbelievably heavy. Like, you look at the list of the recipes and it's always like fried lard with risotto and pancetta. And you're like, oh, God, kill me now. And most notably, she also, since season 2016 to 2017, has started singing the theme tune to the very show. So I think we should listen to that.
We definitely should.
Benvenuti a tutti, amici miei. Ogni giorno è festa insieme a voi. Pasta e fantasia, musica e allegria. Questa è la ricetta della felicità.
Can I just apologise that we came back from that so soon? Loving that here. What? Sure, that would top the tree in the charts, wouldn't it, Fernando?
I would love that. And I'm a big fan of Italian music, especially from those icons. It sounds almost like Raffaella Carrà a little bit.
I think there's a bit of cross-pollination.
Yes. Now, it's a lot of fun. Is there anything with a little more heft? I mean, does Italian TV strike a more sober note even a little at this time of year?
Of course. If you're looking for gravitas, and I hope that you appreciate my choice of Latin word, we should head towards Alberto Angela. Now, this is the son of Piero Angela, who is essentially Italy's equivalent to the UK's David Attenborough. So the grandfather of documentaries with the soothing voice and the apparent impression that he knows everything about anything that's ever been created on the planet. So whilst Piero does mainly the nature stuff, Alberto is a paleontologist by trade and very good at archaeology. So all of the historical reenactments on Italian telly come by way of Alberto Angela. And what's really funny about it is that he's become somewhat of a weird sex icon.
I was going to say, he's in the newspaper, he's rendered in a sort of pen and ink drawing, and he doesn't necessarily look the type.
But wouldn't you be a little bit intrigued by a 55-year-old paleontologist?
I'm intrigued now, certainly. And I guess, is there a sense to which he sort of plays up to that maybe a little?
I don't think he does it intentionally, but what he does do is he has these very, very overstressed hand gestures, which have actually earned him a series of parodies as well on Italian comedy shows, because every time he approaches a subject, he's always so enthusiastic. And, you know, as an Italian, I do an awful lot of hand gestures, but that is on another level.
Taking it to a new level. Well, you can read Chiara's insights into those and others, indeed, in the first edition of the Monaco Winter Weekly newspaper. In the fourth iteration, as I understand it, Fernando, your take on your motherland's festive television treats and general staples. You've got a couple you want to tell us about.
Absolutely. And I think I've been living here in the UK for 10 years. I think the big difference here, you guys do cozy very well. You know, you do like, Christmas, warm, let's make something. In Brazil, we don't do cozy. You know, it's very musical. It's very sweaty and very bouncy in some ways, you know.
And sweaty and bouncy. I must say that does rather conform to my expectations on this front.
No, it's a bit of a cliche, but it's true. I think we're going to start with Show da Virada, which is they broadcast that every year at Globo, which is our main broadcaster. I think it starts around, it's on New Year's Eve. It starts around 8 p.m. and it goes until the 1st of January. And the thing with that, it's a pre-recorded show. So this year, I think they pre-recorded already in Belo Horizonte. And everybody's wearing white. And it's usually a lot of musicians singing. But, you know, when you look, I mean, it's you think it's the 31st, you know, because there's like Happy New Year and everybody's wearing white and everybody's vibrating. So it's a bit of a lie, really, you know.
So just let me go back up. It's sweaty, bouncy, and everyone's vibrating.
Exactly.
Good to just to jump in and clear that one up, Fernando.
But there's a little weird thing, because when it's actually approaching midnight, I think actually they go very quickly live to Rio to show the counting, you know, 10, 9, and actually we have a clip of that, if you don't mind.
No, let's take a listen.
Let's listen.
That was a bit kind of moodier than I was expecting.
Yeah, that was a bit Disney-esque, yeah.
That wasn't that bouncy, Fernando. That was not quite portentous.
Yeah, there was no vibration there.
No vibration at all, I'm assured, by Kiara.
It's just the you know, the emotion that the New Year's coming. But it's a good show, and every year, you know, they choose the best-selling artists. I think this year there'll be a lot of country music, Sertanejo, Simone e Simaria, and I think a lot of people we are looking forward to hear from Chitãozinho and Chororó. They are one of the most famous country duos. They've been performing for almost 50 years, and they love their cowboy hats as well.
Excellent, don't we all? Can you follow that with anything else?
Yes, there's another one that I'll give you a preview. It's Roberto Carlos, which is, we've been discussing actually this morning, because, you know, Johnny Hallyday died in France and we're talking like, what are the main pop stars that nobody knows? Roberto Carlos sold more than 120 million albums. That's quite a lot. And he's been having like an annual show on Globo since 1974. There was only one year when he didn't perform because his wife died. That was in 99. I mean, he's massive in Brazil. Everybody knows him. And even, you know, he's not my kind of music, but, you know, I kind of know quite a lot of some of his tracks. And for example, this year, I can already, he's going to show on the 23rd of December, I can give you a preview. He's going to sing Despacito in his own version.
Wow. Even this old man knows that's a big deal, Fernando.
But I chose a clip of one of my favorite songs, and it's funny, I'm not religious myself, but this song is called Jesus Cristo or Jesus Christ. But it's so nice and it makes me sing along.
Okay.
And that was from last year's show.
Okay, let's take a listen and feel free to sing along if you want, Fernando. And there was me, Fernando, thinking I knew about the most important Roberto Carlos to have come out of Brazil. I was wrong. It's not the footballer. It's this guy.
I can tell you we've been having problems with the image department, because she was like, oh, he's not the guy, the football player with huge thighs. It's Roberto Carlos.
He may have big thighs. I don't know. How are his thighs? Modest.
It's modest. Yeah, I was going to say something, but that's too gossipy to say. I'll keep it as a secret.
I almost feel we need to push that further, but no, let's... perhaps we should leave it there. Fernando and Kiara, thank you both for being in. And if that hasn't whetted your appetites, listeners, to get stuck into the Monocle Winter Weekly newspaper, I literally don't know what will. Find out more information about it at the website. Thanks to Kiara and Fernando. Don't forget to read more in the Monocle Winter Weekly. Find the information at the website. And Fernando joins me now here in the studio alongside Alice and Matt to round off the show with this week's Global Countdown. Faye, where are we going this week?
We're heading to Greece, Stone. And first, okay. I'd like to say thanks to two members of our staff, Adele and Daphne. Daphne's from Greece and Adele is half Greek as well. They helped me because it was quite tough finding the names. But it's a very interesting chart, the Greek one, I have to say. Not my favourite kind of music, but I have to say it's quite unique. Right. We like that, right?
Okay. Often unique
is good.
Unique. Well, I don't know. Sometimes worries me, Matt, in advance.
We'll see.
But look, the truth will out. Faye, we must start with number 5.
Absolutely. And by the way, all of them, they're very broody looking and it's quite folky as well.
Okay.
Number 5, we have Yorgos Yanias with Logika. And again, I think Yorgos is a bit old. Well, not that old. I mean, he's in his late 30s.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God. I'm retiring tomorrow.
How dare you?
No, but he's got quite established a career in Greece.
He's like Ronan Keating for Greece.
Yes. Wow.
Very good.
You stole my words.
Oh,
basically.
No. Sorry, Faye. I'm piped down.
But you know, it's an alright song. You know, that's all I can say.
Okay.
Number four, the only non-Greek entry there is from the Revivalists. Have you guys have heard of this American
Rings
band?
A tiny bell.
No. They're like kind of, they describe their styles as roots rock, and roots they're rock. From New Orleans.
Okay.
So it feels like quite 50s kind of rock and roll track. It's called Wish I Knew You. It's quite interesting that they are on the Greek charts, because this song was released, I think, back in May. It did relatively successful in the US in the rock charts, but that's it.
So kind of a slice of Southern, a bit nostalgic, the tone maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe that appeals.
I think they like that nostalgia because, for example, there's no hip-hop or tropical house in the whole of the top five, for example.
Maybe there's an interesting Southern States, Southern European crossover vibe.
Who knows?
That
Who
could
knows?
Be interesting, couldn't it?
I doubt it, but
Matt looks pretty unconvinced, I should
Seems
say.
An unlikely alliance.
Yeah, but you never know. What's at three, Fernando?
Number three, we have a very polished guy. That's all I can say. He looks like a statue in a way. In a good way, perhaps. Konstantinos Argyros. He's much younger, and the song's called Psemata. Again, nothing new in the song. Very straight ballad. I was even chatting with Daphne. She said that's the kind of music you would hear if you were in a cab in Greece.
Right.
So okay. Apparently cab drivers love it.
Okay. It's like magic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Magic FM via Greece. Number two is very special to me because it's a duo between Elena Paparizou and Anastasio Ramos with the song An Me Dis Na Kleo. The thing is, I do love Elena Paparizou. I don't know if you guys remember. She won Eurovision 2005 with My Number One. And she's Greek-Swedish, actually. She was born in Sweden from Greek parents. And she made her career there in Sweden. But I think now she's kind of back to the land of her her parents. And she's the coach of The Voice Greece. You know, she's a major superstar.
Okay.
The song, a bit disappointing, is a bit more to the ballad side as well. So, again, She's done better in the
Can
past.
Can I ask for a quick translation? Amidis Nakleo, what does that mean? Do you know?
I haven't done...
Fair, your research. I don't know. It's looking a bit rough around the edges.
Yeah.
Come on then. What's at the top of the tree? And do we need to be warned or do we need to settle in for this?
I think you guys should listen to it and tell me what you think. Let's hear. This is Nikos I Monopoulos with Ia Kapio Loho. Ήταν φαίνεται μοιραίο να μ' αφήσεις Σε αγάπησα για να με τραυματίσεις Και στη γη να με κρεμίσεις ουρανέ Για κάποιο λόγο γίναν όλα Κι ίσως κάποτε θελήσεις να τα βρούμε Για ένα λόγο μας συμβαίνουν όσα ζούμε Και μπορεί
There you go, Faye. Lots of talk around the table here in Studio One about that. What's your thoughts?
Ellis, what do you think?
I mean, it's clearly terrible, but it did remind me of the very good and underrated banger by Mel C and Bryan Adams, which I can only sing and not remember the name of. But
When You're Gone.
Baby, When You're Gone.
Baby, exactly.
I knew that I'm in love. Exactly. A very good song.
That's funny. Because there were definitely Adams-esque notes, I think, to that. A little
it's the
flavor.
Thrash of the guitar.
Yeah, could be.
Would you agree, Matt?
I just want to know if it comes with a taverna attached.
Yes.
Because obviously everything now is about the food. So that would be good to eat by.
Just eating thinking of the dal.
Mm. And to be honest with you, I care a lot about the visuals as well. And I have to say, he's got a dark blonde hair at the moment, but when he was younger, my God, he was like this kind of platinum blonde. It really didn't match his face that well.
Like George Michael.
Worse.
George Michael is great. Like.
But you know, I'm glad Nico's still there. He won. He became famous. He won one of those reality shows called Drink Show, The Music Chew, which I presume was the second season. Then he's there, number
there
one.
There he is, top of the
Not
of the
my
tree,
favorite, but well done.
Well done, Nico. Well done for reining back on your platinum hair.
Yes. Dark blonde suits you so well.
Wonderful stuff. That brings us, perhaps mercifully, who knows, to the end of today's programme. Thanks very much to my guests, Alice Vincent and Matt Wolf. And the show was produced by Holly Fisher and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Thank you, Faye, as ever. My name's Tom Edwards. We'll be back at the same time next week. But for now, I'm afraid I do have to do this to you. Let's play out with some more of Nikos at the top of the Greek charts. Thanks for listening. Σε συνάντησα και τώρα σε έχω χάσει Ούτε δάκρυ μου δε σ' έχει ξεθοριάσει Σαν μελάνι στο βρεγμένο μου χαρτί